Thank you. Hey, everybody. My name's Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. Debbie Simmons. You're going to hear the other half of the story. So I want to thank Sam for asking me to come up here and speak. I heard you all have a real active group up here. You have a good reputation, and that's a good thing, you know, carrying the message. And self-will run riot, I can't relate. That's all I heard when I first got sober. Your self-will run riot. You know, my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My story's pretty long because I had some sobriety and went back out and tested the waters, and it almost killed me. The progression of this disease. I was born and raised, believe it or not, in the Bronx, New York. I came from, my father's Italian, my mother's Irish. It was like a salad. It did not mix. And, you know, growing up, my mother was the alcoholic, and it was very hard. I'm an only child, and, you know, my mother drank a lot, and I was small. I was probably 5 years old, and all I remember is my mother drinking and my father beating her. My mother drinking more and my father beating her. That's all I remember. I remember sitting in closets, you know, so I couldn't hear it. And being an only child, I went to private school. The nuns weren't very nice to me. And, you know, I just felt really alone at a very young age. I believe that we're born with this disease. I could be wrong, but I felt different from the very start, you know. I never fit in. I was never a part of. I never belonged anywhere. My father eventually divorced my mother. My mother, she ended up getting sober. God rest her soul. This program saved her life, and it gave her a family back. She got sober when I was 7 years old. And I remember she called. Well, she passed away now, but when she told her story, she said when she got sober in 1970-something. She died with 40 years sobriety. And when she told her story, she called AA, she thought, and it was AAA, and they sent a tow truck, and that used to just crack me up. You know, she got sober really a long time ago. Back then, it was men that came in the house to 12-step, and two men, I remember, came into the house and took my mom away, and I didn't know where she went, and nobody told me. And she came home like a month later, and that was it. It was over, you know. She was sober. And I remember back then they gave her candy. And as a kid, I loved candy, so I would eat her candy. And, oh, my gosh, you know, trying to get sober, don't eat a woman's Hershey bar. And but she, you know, And I didn't understand anything that was going on, and nobody ever told me. My father remarried. My mother met a gentleman in Alcoholics Anonymous 3 months sobriety. She also had codependency. The guy had a day sober. So what happened was my mother took this guy under her wing, and the insanity started again with him. So I didn't know where I fit in, where I belonged, It was just a lonely growing up. I remember visiting my father, and his wife had kids, and I remember sitting there thinking, I'm just not a part of here, you know. And it never left me. So as I progressed, you know, I went to school in the Bronx, and as I got older, I just felt alone. And this disease is one that makes us feel alone. And I did okay in school. I, going to school, I remember, you know, with my father, nothing was ever good enough. If I got a B, I should have gotten an A. If I got, you know, it was just never good enough. And he was abusive to me, too. My father is also in active addiction. He's 73 years old, and I don't think he'll ever get this program. He'll probably die in active drinking and addiction. And that I've accepted that today, you know. I went to a Catholic high school, and it was okay, you know. I remember my first drink was when I was 15 years old. I remember it was Johnny Walker Black. Ugh. And my brother-in-law kept filling my glass, and it was New Year's Eve, and all I remember is just drinking it. I loved it. My first drink, I loved it. I loved it because it took me out of me. It made me feel like I belonged. It made me feel like I was a part of, you know, that first drink. And I was 15. I remember just sitting there with family and just falling backwards. And the next morning I woke up, I had feety pajamas on, and they were all wrapped around my leg. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm in so much trouble. And I couldn't wait to do it again. You know? And that was pretty much the course. Back in New York, the drinking age was 18 growing up. So, hoo-hoo, you know? I will mention two drugs. Only because if it happened to me, it could happen to you. I'm not unique. And the first drug I was introduced to in New York City, it was running rampant, was cocaine. Back in the 70s and the late 70s, early 80s, oh my gosh, it was everywhere. So my senior prom, I remember prom, but then after prom we went into Manhattan to the Copacabana. And I was 18 years old, I was drinking kamikazes. They're good going down, they're awful coming up. And kamikazes and cocaine. And I found a drug that let me drink as much as I could. And I liked it. I liked it. Couldn't get enough, you know. So at 18 years old, here I was running. I didn't have problem getting jobs back then. You didn't need a college degree. I had a couple of good jobs in Manhattan, Rockefeller Center, and you know, I thought at 18 years old I had the world. You know, this is great. Life was good. For a little while it was fun, you know, in the beginning, but it started becoming not fun anymore. It started becoming a necessity. I needed it. And I remember, you know, my first introduction to sobriety. My father took me to a place in the Bronx called Daytop. And I remember sitting there, and I opened the refrigerator, and they had urine in the refrigerator, and I was just appalled by it, you know. So I called my mom up and said, they have urine in their refrigerator, you know. This is just unacceptable. And, you know, people were off the streets, and I couldn't relate to that. I had a home. I had a car. I had a family. And I was young. You know, this is what young people do. They drink, they party, they have fun. I remember, you know, when it didn't become fun anymore, I was in my house, and after I started drinking, I woke up at places that I don't even know. Like, my family got up one morning to have breakfast, and I was sleeping on the dining room table. I thought it was my bed. My head was in a flower pot, and my father would say, What are you doing here? I don't know. Were you drinking? I only had two. You know, that was the magic number, two. And then I'd take showers with my clothes on, you know, walk by the room. Here I am, soaking wet, clothes on. You know, I mean, I was young, and this is what it was doing to me. And I never knew what a blackout was. And I was blacking out in my teens, you know. Didn't know. It was scary, but it didn't stop me, you know. And I remember my friends calling me up, hey, you want to go have a drink? My theory was, hey, you want to go get drunk? I don't know about a drink, you know. And I only hung out with people that got drunk. So anyway, you know, it progressed from there. I got really bad. And my first AA meeting, it was in the Bronx, New York, and I remember the only reason I went, because my father always told me, you're going to be just like your mother. That's all I heard. You're going to be just like your mother. And I tried so hard to be not like my mother. You know, today I'm very grateful to be like my mother. So anyway, my first meeting was 18 years old. I remember walking in, you know, I had heels on and I was ready to roll, just get this party over with. And wait, let me back up. I couldn't use the vehicle, so I had to call for a ride in the Bronx. And I remember this car pulls up. Yeah, we'll come pick you up. And it looked like Ma and Pa Kettle. They were like 80 years old and married. And I'm sitting in the back seat going, are you kidding me? So they took me to an old timers meeting, which was more old people. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, my life, I ain't ready for this. I don't qualify yet. I got to be 90. And that gentleman gave me a copy. He was an old-timer, bless his heart. And he gave me a copy of How It Works, and he said, take it home and read this and go over it. So I went over it, you know, and I thought the 12 steps were 12 questions to qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous, so I answered them. Powerless over alcohol, yeah, sometimes, you know, and I filled it out, and I went back the next day. I did go back. And I gave it to him, and he said, what is this? I said, I was answering those questions. And he said, honey, keep coming back. Yeah, I thought I was done, you know. That shows how much I knew. And I didn't keep coming back, you know. My life progressively got very, very bad. And I was in bad places. And my mother at the time was married to this guy, my stepfather, who I tried to live with my mother for a little while, and he was drinking. And when he got drunk, he was a Vietnam veteran, and he relived that every day. And I'd find him up in trees, and it was just bad. And I was scared, fear again, you know. So although as I got older, my mother was sober, and she had been sober for quite a while when I went for my geographical change. And I remember calling my mom and saying, you know, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. I'm dying here. And she said, you know, get a flight and I'll pick you up at the airport. She was in Stephen City, Virginia at the time. And when she picked me up, I had a broken nose because I was in a fight with somebody, broken ribs. I was a mess. I was a mess. And I remember she put me in the car and we were driving Route 50 to Stephen City, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is like cows and pastures. Perfect. And she took me to Stephen City, Virginia, and I said, okay, so where I get the subway? She said, there ain't no subway. I said, where I get the bus? There are no buses. Cab? There are no cabs. I think what people do around here. Long story short, I found people just like me. You know, my mom at the time was a counselor for a halfway house. And I came here and I found people just like me. And I started going out to places called Piggies. They don't have a place like that in the Bronx. And all these bars, you know, and finding all kinds of men, and life was good again, you know, drinking, and there I was back at it, just with different people, country people, you know, country people, and doing the same thing I always did. The problem was I took me with me, and I didn't know at the time I was the problem. That was the problem. It was me. And I kept running. So anyway, I used to go to this bar called the Green Gables, and I met this guy there who I thought was my dream come true. My picker's broke, too. It was very broke, because I like sick people like me. And I met this gentleman, and, you know, whatever, go home and whatever. And I was drunk, and I remember a couple days later we started going out. He gave me a pretty good beating, you see, because to me that was normal. That's what I grew up with, you know. In my head, that's what normal was. And when he gave me that beating, he broke my ribs again. And I remember going to the hospital, and they said, "Is there any chance that you can be pregnant?" And I was like, "Pregnant? I don't know. You know, who the hell, who thinks of that?" And they came back and said, "Congratulations, you're pregnant." And I was like, "This guy just beat me, and I'm pregnant. And what do? I married him. Because if he had me, he was going to change." That was the thought. If he had me, he was going to change. And I went through my pregnancy, and we got married, and I was just, he lived on top of a mountain, which was so not me. None of it was me. And I just was like a chameleon trying to fit in. You know, they always say that square peg trying to fit in a round hole. That's me, my whole life. And so we went through a little bit, and of course that didn't work out. And I started getting really bad. I wanted to die at this point. I thought, you know what? I can't live my life like this. I mean, I'm young, and I just want to check out. I just don't want to live like this anymore. And I tried suicide 3 times. This first time I tried it, it was in New York, and I tried to put my head in the oven, you know, get the gas fumes, because, you know, the movies I watched, it always worked. So I was very, you know, dramatic. And I remember my landlord called the fire department, and the fire department came in and said, "Well, you have the gas on, don't you smell it?" And I'm thinking, I'm trying to die, dude, here, you know? And he just rained on my parade. And I remember my dad telling me, "You don't even know how to kill yourself right." And I thought, "I'll show you. I'll show you, Dad." And so anyway, when I was living up in this mountain, another dramatic shot, I tried to take my car and drive it off a cliff. I was highly intoxicated at the time. And up in Linden Mountain, you got a pretty good mountain up there. And I took my car, and I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to do it." And I go off the cliff, and I hit a tree stump, which I didn't know was a tree stump at the time, but my car just stopped. And I thought, "Oh, my gosh, what do I do? I had no shoes on. I was highly intoxicated. How do I get up the mountain?" You know, I managed to get up the mountain. I called my mom, said, "Mom, I got a problem." She said, "What's wrong?" I said, "The car went off the road." Had the car go off the road. I took a wrong turn. "Oh, okay." So, and she was a very good enabler, too. She enabled me very well. So she came up and got the car. And my last suicide attempt, I was with this guy still, you know, I took pills. Don't ever take Tylenol. They won't kill you. They just make your ears ring. And you go deaf for a very long time. So I took a bottle of Tylenol, and I took what said Darvocet pills, I thought they were. And my ears were ringing. I said, "Great, I'm going to live. I'm going to be deaf." And after a couple of hours, I had to go to the hospital because I was deathly sick. Didn't die. And I remember the doctor came in and said, "You know, I got some good news and some bad news." And I said, "Whatever." And he said, "The good news is you're going to live." He said, "The bad news is that Darvocet you took was dog deworming pills." He said, "You don't have to worry about worms for a very long time." So, you know, my history of trying to kill myself stopped at that point. You know, I thought, there's got to be a better way of life here, you know. And I remember at the time when I was drinking, I take my mom's car, okay, and her car had all these bumper stickers on it. "I cruise without booze. I'm a friend of Bill W." You know, all this stuff. So I thought, if I took it to get drunk, the police won't pull me over. Because they'll see the bumper stickers on the car, you know, and know I'm in the program. My thinking was so warped. But anyway, you know, my mom was in this halfway house. And I remember visiting it. And these people were sober. And I thought, I don't know about all this, you know. So anyway, I was 20-something years old, and I remember they were talking to me, saying, "Debbie, just try Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. You got nothing to lose." And at 26 years old, I liked what these people had, even in the halfway house. You know, they had hope. They weren't drinking like I did. And they didn't have very much time, but I wanted what they had. You know, they looked starting to look happy. And so anyway, I started to go to meetings, and there was this gentleman, you know, I loved men, and my picker was very broke. But there was a gentleman who had just gotten out of the halfway house, I don't know. And he was from New York, and I thought he was cute. And I started going to some meetings, you know, started trying to get sober. And I remember asking him, you know, let's go out. You know, he was hip from New York, and he listened to the same music. And he said, there's a problem here, Deb. And I said, what's that? He said, I'm gay. So when I started going to meetings, they told me I had to get a sponsor. And I hated women. I truly hated women. I didn't think I wanted to trust. I didn't know what it was all about. And so I asked him to sponsor me. He was gay. So when he told me he was gay, I was like, okay, so will you sponsor me? And he said, huh? I said, well, we can't get into a relationship, you know. I was always bucking the system. And so anyway, he did sponsor me for a little while. And it worked. It kept me sober. And I really wanted it. And I did what the old timers started to do, what the old timers told me to do. You know, I started going to meetings. My mom went to the same meetings as me. So I didn't want people to know she was my mom, because she would piss people off in the halfway house. And I wanted to have friends. So I would walk in a meeting and I'd call her Barb. Hey, Barb, what's up? You know, so people wouldn't know that I was her daughter. And I managed to get some sobriety behind my belt. But there was a problem, one problem. Y'all told me no relationships for a year. I didn't like that one, you know. So I had to book the system on that. And when I came in, you know, even though I wasn't drinking, I still liked sick men. And I thought I was going to find the Brady Bunch in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. There are sick men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found them all. All of them. And I remember I met this guy, and he probably had a month, I don't know. And I ended up getting pregnant again. And it was just very disappointing to me. And I remember going to my mom and saying, I'm pregnant again. And she's like, oh my gosh, you know, haven't you ever heard of birth control? And so anyway, I ended up going into treatment, Boxwood. And I remember right before I went into Boxwood, there was an old timer that went to this meeting on Sensenie Road. And I used to come into meetings crying all the time. You know, I was just one of those annoying people. And I remember he told me in the meeting, shut up. You don't know nothing about staying sober, obviously. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he really pissed me off. His name was Johnny Welch. And so I walked out of the meeting, and I ended up getting drunk. And I was pregnant. And that's what brought me to Boxwood. So I went through Boxwood for 30 days. My first day at Boxwood, they said, we're going to have a meeting at 8 o'clock. And somebody's bringing it in. And I was like, okay. So I go sit at the table, and who is it? Johnny Welch. And he said, fancy seeing you here. You know, he was right. I didn't know a thing about staying sober. I thought I did. Because I grew up in Alatot, Alateen, Alanon, Ala everything. So I thought I had the education to not be an alcoholic. You know, I didn't know nothing about staying sober. So as I went through Boxwood, I stayed sober. I came out and did what I had to do. I got sponsors, started going to meetings, 90 and 90. I got active. I did service work, and I managed to get sobriety. 3 years into sobriety, I went to school to be a respiratory therapist. And, you know, I didn't want to go to college after I graduated because I thought I couldn't do it. I didn't want to start something that I fail at because I thought I was a failure. So going to college, 3 years into sobriety, was huge for me. And going for a respiratory therapist was even more huge, you know. So I managed to do that. And there was, I had my daughter, okay, at this time. So now I had two children. I had my daughter and my son. The gentleman just took off and never met his daughter. So I had two children, but I still had a problem. I thought I needed to be in a relationship because I didn't want to be alone. I hated being alone with me. So I had a sponsor at the time, and she had a lot of time in the program. And I met this guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to her and said, I met this really nice guy. You know, he's so spiritual. And I remember her looking at me and saying, Debbie, you wouldn't know spirituality if it hit you in the butt. And she fired me. Yeah, she fired me. She was tough love, you know. So I met this guy, and I ended up marrying him. And because he was so spiritual, you know, he's in AA, he's got some time. And he was the angriest individual I ever met. And I ended up getting pregnant. And I had my youngest son. And, of course, it didn't work. It didn't work because, once again, I was the problem. I brought my I brought me into every relationship thinking that the relationship was going to fix me. You know, I brought children into the world thinking they were going to fill the void in my heart, not about what I could give them, but what they could give me. And that was the problem. It was all about me. You know, fill that void. Don't let me hurt. And it got me into some situations in sobriety. So anyway, you know, I went to school. I graduated. At this point, I had three children. I was a single mom because I left them. And I became a respiratory therapist. And I started working. And I have a problem with testing. So when I went to go take my state board, I failed it. And I remember at 3 years sobriety, I get this paper that says, you have failed, in bold letters, this test. And it told me I failed in life. That's what I saw. A failure again, you know. And it was around Christmas time, and humility. I had to have some humility because now I had three children to take care of. And I got a job working for Santa Claus. And I was an elf. And I remember with all these screaming kids, being an elf with my elf shoes and my elf hat, and these nurses coming that I used to work with at the hospital, saying, what happened? You're an elf. Yeah, no kidding. You know, and I was like, I couldn't, you know, pass my test, whatever. Now, when I was working at the hospital, I met a gentleman. His name was John Downs, and he was a paraplegic from his neck down. And I used to take him around the hospital, and you know, he became my friend, and he told me he met Mother Teresa and all these people, and I thought he was full of it. I never believed him, and but after I lost my job, I didn't see him anymore. Well, one night I was really bummed out, and I wanted to get drunk. I probably had 4 years into this gig, and I threw my elf hat off and said, I quit. I don't want to be an elf no more. And I didn't know what I was going to do that night, get drunk or whatever, but I remember hearing a voice calling me, Debbie, and I turned around, and it was this gentleman, John Downs. And being a paraplegic, he told me, don't give up. Don't give up before the miracle. Take that test again. You're going to pass it. You have a lot to give. That man might have saved my life that night. Might have saved my life. And I studied for that test, and I passed it. I became a respiratory therapist, you know. I believe that nothing good comes easy for me. I'm an alcoholic. I got to work for it. Because if it came easy, I wouldn't appreciate it. Because that's the way I am. So I had to work a little bit harder than the other people, and that's okay, you know. So anyway, my husband today was my friend back then, and, you know, he started taking a liking to my children, and, you know, for the first time I had somebody in my life that I became friends with first. I didn't know how to be a friend either, you know. it was always something going on. And he became my friend, and he became my husband, and he adopted my children. And it takes a big man to adopt somebody else's children. And he took care of my children and raised them. So Ronnie became my husband, and I was working and doing my thing, and I stayed sober. Sobriety was good. It was really good. What happened was, you know, our life progressed, and me and Ronnie were married, and I was living in Northern Virginia, and I was working, and some bad things happened to my son, my youngest son. He was a victim of a crime, a very bad crime. And then I had a stroke after that. And I remember being in the hospital. At this point, I'm going to skip up because I did stay sober for 12 years. And I had just celebrated my 12-year anniversary, and I was angry. I was so angry. And I was sitting in the hospital, and they put me on a wonderful drug. Here's the second drug I'm going to mention, is Xanax. And, ooh, I loved it, you know? They put me on Xanax, and what happened was they discharged me with a bottle of 300. And they say there's going to come a time when the only thing between you and a drink is God. You know, if you don't have God, may you find him now. Because that's what happened to me. I was mad at God. And I ended up going back out after almost 13 years sobriety. And it was bad. It was really bad. I was confused because I hadn't drank yet, and I kept asking people, it wasn't a relapse, you know, it wasn't a relapse, I didn't drink, and they're like, but Debbie, you're in the blackout, you know, so I took care of that problem, and I got drunk, because I didn't want to question anything, and I thought, you know, I became like the mad scientist, because 13 years sobriety, they came out with Zima. I used to see those commercials on TV, you know, thinking, Zima, oh, that looks good. So my husband traveled at the time, and I had the blender out. It was like everything, you know, couldn't get enough, and there I was back to the races. And the problem was this time the progression of my disease. It progressed, you know. I wasn't 26 anymore, and it was bad. That progression, I tell you. And it kept me out there for 7 years of hell. 7 years. People say you die. My story is it was a long, painful life. I couldn't die. And I tried every day. I tried every day. My bottom after 7 years was being in Fairfax Hospital for a month on life support, bleeding out of every orifice that you could imagine. And they couldn't get the blood in quick enough. And my husband, who was in sobriety, sitting there watching his wife die. And there was nothing anybody can do to save me. I had a mother who was sober. I had a husband who was sober. My friends had been sober. There was nothing anybody could do to stop the freight train. And when I got out of Fairfax Hospital, I thought I wanted sobriety, but I went right back at it again because I didn't know how to stop. So my husband intervened to put me in a treatment center in Salem, Virginia, called Mount Regis. And I went through that treatment center, and I got sober again by the grace of God. By the grace of God, you know. I speak up here with gratitude for all you, because without you, there's no me. So anyway, I stayed sober. I got active, you know, all the things I didn't do the first time. I had almost 13 years sobriety, never read the big book. I hated that thing. It was boring. I thought it should have been rewritten because it was by old people. So you all told me I had to read the big book, steps and stuff like that. So I got really active this time. I started making coffee. I started asking for help. We didn't have a big book meeting in Shenandoah County, so I started one, you know, because they told me if I want it, go get it. So I started a big book meeting, which forced me to read the big book. I got really active in district and started doing what I needed to do. My sobriety date is April 17, 2009. I hope I never forget it again. And I started getting, you know, pumped on Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 2009, I lost my stepmother. And I only had 6 months sobriety, and it was really hard. 2010, I lost a lot. 2010 was a bad year. You know, you all told me if I came in here, things get better. Well, I'm here to tell you sometimes things don't get better. You get better, you know, if you don't drink. And 2010 was a nightmare. I sent my son into war, into Afghanistan, and I had a best friend who was dying of cancer, and his name was Lamont. And you know what? You all told me how to be a friend. You all showed me that. I was able to be a friend. 2010, he went into the hospice unit, and I had a trip planned at the time, but I spent the nights with him, you know, just taking care of him so his wife could go home. And I remember I had that trip planned, and I thought he was going to die when I was gone. And I remember sitting there one night, he had 20 years sobriety, and I used to call him bro, you know. And I said, bro, what are we going to do? And he said, sis, I've been blessed with 20 years sobriety. He said, I was supposed to die 20 years ago. And I thought, how do you get there? You know, and it just filled my heart with gratitude. And when I left for my trip to Aruba, I said goodbye to him, and we got his funeral ready and stuff like that. And me, my husband, and a good friend of ours, Janie Whitaker, flew to Aruba. And I got a phone call that changed my life in Aruba, that my mom was unresponsive, taken to a hospital. And they told me that she had two ventricles left in her brain. She had a brain aneurysm. And they said, do you want to put her on life support? And I said, no, not if she's not going to be okay. And I flew back. And I remember I had to fly home alone because there was only one seat on the plane. And I remember flying home thinking, you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous gave me sobriety. I was able to be a daughter, you know? And I didn't have any regrets at that point because of you all, because of this program. And I remember getting to the hospital feeling very afraid, fear. And I walked into the waiting room, and there was about 25 other alcoholics waiting for me because I got active in AA. I became in the center of the herd. And I remember walking in that waiting room, and everybody was waiting for me, and I thought, oh, my gosh, you know? You don't get that anywhere. You don't get that anywhere. And they stayed with me. They stayed with me. They held my hand and walked me through that. And I watched my mom die. And I remember it was a Friday. I got a phone call that my friend Lamont died. And on Monday, my mother died. And I had two funerals to go to. At that point was when I reached, hit my knees in my mom's bathroom, and I said, God, please, just carry me through. Just get me through this. My mom died with 40 years sobriety, and like I said today, I'm proud to be like my mom. I'm proud to be like my mom. I just wish I told her more when she was here. Right after my mom died, my stepfather got really sick. That man I didn't like, I had to take care of him. You all gave me that gift. You gave me that gift. I took care of my stepdad at my house, the man I didn't like. And he fell and broke his hip, and I had to put him in an assisted living. Now, when all this was happening, when my mom got sick, my son was home. for his 2-week leave from Afghanistan. He had just said goodbye to her. It was a Wednesday night. And he was getting ready to fly back out Thursday to Afghanistan. And she died. I mean, she had the aneurysm that night. And he stayed home. So as all this was going on, I also had to put my son back on plane back to Afghanistan. So there was a lot of things, you know. And I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to stay sober, you can stay sober. You got to want it. You got to want it. You got to want to stay sober more than you want to be drunk. And I had to get to that point. I held on for dear life. And I remember it was a Tuesday night. I went to her Strasbourg meeting because when my mom passed, guess what I did? I went to a meeting. That's what I did. Even though I was hurting, I sat in that chair and I went to that meeting. And I remember I went into the bathroom, and I've been in that bathroom before, but there was wallpaper, and it said, "Be still and know that I am God." And my mom had meditation books. And after I read that message, I went into her 24-hour book. I was just flipping through it. And in a folded-up piece of paper in her writing said, "Be still and know that I am God." And I knew there are no coincidences. When my mom was dying, I was walking the hallway, and this woman was sitting outside reading a magazine, and she said, "Are you okay, honey?" I said, "No, my mom's dying." She said, "It'll be okay. You will be okay." She said, "You're tan." You know, okay. And I said, "I just came back from Aruba." She said, "Aruba, can you come in and talk to my father-in-law? He's dying." And him and his wife always used to go to Aruba. So God took me out of myself to be with somebody else. And I went in there, and that man hugged me and told me about him and his wife back in the day. And I remember standing up and getting to walk out, and she gave me this big hug like we give in AA. And I thought, okay, this is a little weird. And she said, "You're a member of Bill W." And I said, "How do you know that?" "Well, I had my medallion on." She said, "I got 25 years sobriety." God put her in my life in that hospital. So I knew God was working in my life, you know. And for the first time out of pain and all that stuff, I found a God of my understanding, you know. I got to be plunging sometime into submission. And, you know, a lot of things happen. And there was a lot of loss. You know, when I sent my son back in Afghanistan, I thought, please don't let nothing happen to him. I don't know. You know, there's only so much sometimes the human will can take. And he did make it home, you know. So anyway, with all that being said, what time is it? Okay. With all that being said, when I was going through 2010 and I thought it was the worst year, when I surrendered totally, things started happening for the good. My daughter's father, who she had never met, I got a paper. She was 18 years old to go to court with him for child support. And I was thinking, she's 18 years old and I don't need you now. But I went into court because sometimes you don't know what God's got in store, you know, but we got to be open to it. You got to be open to it. And we went to court, and I remember going into the room, and he looked a little different. It was 18 years later, and the judge wanted to put him in jail because it's been 18 years since he paid child support. And I told the judge, "Please don't put him in jail. My daughter's 18 years old. I took care of her. You know, I lived up to my responsibility as a mother." And the judge said, "I've never had a woman in here begging not to put them in jail. I always have them telling them to put them in jail." And I was like, "No, please don't." You know, so he didn't put them in jail. And what ended happening after that happened, we all went out to lunch. And he got to meet his daughter. And she had just graduated. She gave him graduation pictures and stuff like that. And she hugged him and told him she loved him. And he came up to me after that and said, "Thank you for such grace. You people gave me that." He died 3 months later of a drug overdose. I got the message there. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself and put that man in my life for whatever reason. You know, he ended up dying. And she got to meet her dad. So So as I stand here, you know, I'm going to tell you it hasn't been easy. I've had to work for it all. You know, I got really active in AA, like I said. I take the meetings into the jail because I never want to forget where I came from. I am the chair for CPCPI in our district. And I stay active. I stay very active. This program has taught me, you know, I thought that when I came in, life would just be so much better. I've had more loss in this 4 years of sobriety than I've had in a lifetime. But I stayed sober because I wanted to stay sober. In September, I lost a sponsee for the first time. And me and her were supposed to go to a meeting that night. And, you know, I love everybody. And you can't help it sometimes, but love, you know, because that's what the program gives us. And I loved her. She became like my family. And we were supposed to go to a meeting one night. She called me and said her mom was sick, that she wasn't going to go. And the next day I got a phone call. She was dead. And her mom, it was her mom, saying Linda died. They found her in a warehouse dead. And this disease kills. It kills. And I know that today. You know, losing her was really hard. But she had it in her mind one more time. One more time. And we don't know what that time is going to give us. You know, she didn't think she was going to die. She thought she was going to have one more night and come right back. And she had a little bit too much. So, but for the grace of God, and I hate that, you know, but some people have to die in order for some of us to live. And I know that today. So anyway, you all taught me how to be a friend, how to be a daughter, how to be a mother. You all gave me that gift. I'm going to say one more thing. That gentleman that was a paraplegic, okay, I never got to thank him for probably saving my life that night. Last year, I was in the Walmart parking lot. Somebody called me up to ask me how my mom was, and I started crying. And I was in bad shape. I was just a wreck. And I remember going into Walmart, you know, don't kill the messenger. And I have a tendency to do that. I never know who the messenger is going to be. But this woman that used to come to the big book meeting used to annoy me. She was from Al-Anon. And she didn't have a big book meeting. And, you know, I love Al-Anon, but, you know, okay. So, you know, that's when I made the big book meeting a closed meeting. But anyway, so she used to talk, and it was like, okay. Well, I went into Walmart one night, and when I was upset, and I was standing in electronics, and there she was, and I was trying to duck her. And she was like, hey, Debbie, how are you? And I was like, hey. And, you know, she came up to me, and I was all, ugh. And she said, are you okay? I said, no, I'm just having a bad day. I said, I miss my mom more than anything. And she said, Debbie, I used to take care of a man named John Downs. He was a paraplegic. She said, I'm a nurse, and I took care of him for a long time. And he wrote a book on why do bad things happen to good people. And it was his story of being a paraplegic. And I was speaking 2 days later, and she showed up when I was speaking with the book. And when I opened the book to page 21, it said, be still and know that I am God. There are no coincidences in Alcoholics Anonymous. That man once again came into my life. And there were pictures in that book of him with Mother Teresa, believe it or not. I shot the messenger. He was the messenger, you know. And she said he died, but he left that book. And that book has become I mean, I went through every page, you know. So anyway, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, stay around. Don't skip out 5 minutes before the miracle, because I'm a miracle. I am a miracle. I come from the Bronx, New York, from nothing, you know. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never thought I'd say that. Never thought I'd say that. What a gift. And I'm grateful to be sober. Thanks.